We are now on the 15th month, actually, that we've been doing this series. And so this is theme number 15. What we're going to cover today is Jesus accepts James Alpheus. That's his so-called cousin by custom, not by blood, in the town of Nazareth. And Matthew, the IRS man, called an excise man, as disciples. He describes the qualities of true apostles, namely humility, gentleness, patience, detachment, perseverance. And he has trouble with his uncle, again by custom, Alpheus, who feels that Jesus has brought ridicule and shame on the family because he's a maverick. And he cures a dying young woman. These are some of the things we're going to cover. And those of you who have the book, we're beginning on page 500. And the first small chapter is entitled, Jesus accepts James of Alpheus as disciple, and he preaches near Matthew's custom bench. Now the scene is, it is morning in the market square of Capernaum. Jesus has just come from the lake into the square, and he meets his cousins James and Judas. Remember, there are several Judases among the disciples. There's Judas, his cousin, Judas Iscariot, and I believe Judas Thaddeus. So you'll have to separate them. So James and Judas are the cousins who grew up with him as children. He embraces them affectionately, and he asks them about their father. James tells Jesus that his father is against their joining Jesus in his ministry. But they did not listen. However, they're sad and distressed over this. And he adds, between Jesus and my family, I chose you. Here I am. If you want me. If you do not want me, I'll be the most unhappy of all men because I will not have anything, neither your friendship nor the love of my family. So Jesus sheds tears with James, but he's happy to receive him as his disciple. And he promises that James will have great joy in bringing God to men. And he invites the other disciples to welcome James, and he adds, how I long for this hour, for this day, because he was a perfect friend in my childhood and a good brother in my youth. Now, Peter talks about having to pay the tax to Matthew. This is funny. And this is Peter in a big mouth, putting his foot in it all the time. And so he talks about Matthew, quote, that thief, the tax collector, at the customs bench. He has only bad words to describe Matthew, the prophet here, with a crocodile skin. crocodile skin. He'd fit some character today somewhere. I'm trying to fit him in. Jesus first wants to preach to the people nearby and adds that, quote, some honest feeling will enter the exciseman's heart. He has a plan, see? He wants Matthew to hear, but he doesn't go directly to him. But he's zapping him all the time. Jesus then tells Peter that he will pay the tax. Jesus will pay the tax. And so, and not Peter. So Jesus waits in line for all the other people, with the people. And then when his turn comes, on page 502, we pick up the conversation here. He says to Matthew, I am paying for 8 baskets of fish belonging to Simon of Jonas. The baskets are over there, where the servants are standing. You can check if you wish. But honest people should be able to trust each other's word. And I think that you will believe that I am honest. How much do I pay? Matthew, who was sitting at the bench when Jesus says, and I think that you will believe that I am honest, stands up. He is a small, rather elderly man, about Peter's age. But his face has the weary look of the pleasure lover, and he is obviously bewildered. At first he lowers his head, then he raises it and looks at Jesus, and Jesus stares at him gravely, dominating him from his imposing height. How much? Jesus asks again after a few seconds. There is no taxation for the disciple of the master, replies Matthew. And in a lower voice he adds, pray for my soul. I carry it within me, Jesus said, because I am gathering sinners. But why do you not look after it? And Jesus turns his back on him at once and goes back to Peter, who is struck with wonder. Also the others are dumbfounded, and they whisper and wink meaningfully. And so that, see, Jesus doesn't push too much. But in the meantime, as God, he's giving good, sending him thoughts, you know, and making him change his heart. Jesus now begins to speak to the people. He points out that all the necessary trades, labors involved are holy, if they are done with honesty and justice by turning their thoughts to God as they work, instead of turning their thoughts to Satan. Here are some pointers for all of us who are involved in what we call the temporal things of life. He points out that we should not be attached to money and wealth. They pass away and rust along with the body as it lies in the grave, while the soul would be deprived of its eternal happiness. And he adds, I solemnly tell you that it is difficult to gain heaven with riches. On the contrary, heaven is generally lost because of riches. And even if they are obtained honestly or by inheritance, because only few rich people know how to make use of their wealth honestly. And he also adds, you must earn honestly, give back what you have obtained unfairly. Make use of your riches with parsimony and detachment, learning how to become detached from them, because sooner or later they will leave us, whereas good deeds will never leave us. There's a good maxim there, see? All the wealth we may have, the goods of this world, will leave us, whereas good deeds will never leave us. They're our spiritual bank account, high interest. Jesus finishes his talk with the words, when a man humbles himself, when he severs all links with evil passions, such as women or gold, and says, for your sake, O Lord, I will have no more of this, he is really repentant, and God receives him, saying, come, you are as dear to me as an innocent child and a hero. Now remember, it's all intended for Matthew. And Matthew's got big ears. He's absorbing it. And Matthew, of course, has been listening to all this and is touched by it. Jesus is now told that his Aunt Mary Alpheus, remember again, this is by custom, not by blood, that she wants to see him and is waiting for him in Peter's house. She traveled 2 days to get there. Remember, Nazareth is a distance from Capernaum, where he's at now. So she traveled 2 days to get there and is very distressed over her husband's resistance to Jesus and also his sons joining them. She cannot understand why her husband is so strong in his opposition to Jesus. She's fearful that he may die in that disposition and asks Jesus to come and save his soul and body. But Jesus says he cannot and adds, what can I do where there is no faith? Keep that in mind. All through the book you'll see that, and it's also in the Gospels. When Jesus healed somebody, he said, do you believe? And because you believed, you were healed. And here, he doesn't heal him because he doesn't believe. He eventually dies, but he is prepared when he does die. But he makes a promise here that we pick up in page 505, the last paragraph. He says, this is what I will do. I promise peace for your Alpheus on account of your pain, and I give you assurance that you will not be separated from him, and I give you my word that our family will be united again in heaven forever. And as long as I live, and even afterwards, I will grant you so much peace and so much strength that you will become my apostle for so many poor women, whom it will be easier for you, a woman, to contact. You will be my beloved friend in this time of evangelization. Alpheus's death, do not cry, will free you from your duties of a wife and will raise you to the more sublime status of a mystical female priesthood. Remember that word, mystical, not an actual consecration like the priest. So necessary near the altar of the great victim and among so many heathens who will yield more willingly to the holy heroism of female disciples than of male ones. Oh, your name, dear aunt, will be like a bright star in the Christian sky. Do not cry anymore. Go in peace. Be strong, resigned, and holy. And so he dismisses her with a blessing and a kiss, pressing her for a long time to his heart until she becomes calm. And now we pick up on the next chapter. Jesus preaches to the crowd at Bethsaida, page 506. The scene Jesus here is standing in a boat, moored to a pier, while the people are sitting in a semicircle in the sand, listening to him. He's speaking about the opposition that he's encountering from the Pharisees and how they're enslaving the people with all their man-made decrees added to the law of Christ. And we pick up his words here on page 5-6 at the bottom of the page, last paragraph. Man is free, and I have come to make him more free, free from sin, and that concerns the spirit, and free from the chains of a distorted, oppressive religion, which with torrents of words, clauses, precept, suffocates the true word of God, a word which is clear, short, light, easy, holy, and perfect. I have come to sift consciences. I gather my corn on the threshing floor, and I thresh it with the doctrine of sacrifice, and I sift it with a sieve of its own will. He also mentions that Satan, too, will lay snares for them to sift them. And he too, Jesus says, is near to them to also sift them. And he mentions, in other words, that some of the trials we receive are not necessarily from Satan. They're from the Lord. But he says here, Satan, of course, lays snares for you to sift you, and I also circumvent you to sift you. The contestants are two, I and he, meaning Satan. You are in the middle, the duel of love and hatred, of wisdom and ignorance, of good and evil, is over you, around you. I am sufficient to ward off any wicked blow against you. I come between the satanic weapon and you, and I am willing to be wounded in your stead because I love you. But you must ward off your internal blows with your will, running towards me, following my way, which is truth and life. Well, we know what that means. We have interior, what we call temptations of the imagination, and so on. And if we don't use our will to say, no way, cut it off, then we're responsible. He says, use your will. So we are responsible. He now points to the reason why some of the people are opposed to him, namely because he ministered to a woman called the Beauty of Gerozim, a prostitute. We took that last month. And he says that there are men of the town who sinned with her, and there are women who cried because of her, because she was taking them away from their wives. These women rejoiced when they heard that she was struck with leprosy. Now Jesus challenges them in these words in page 508. He says, but I say to you, you must forgive. God took your vengeance, and then God forgave. Namely, he saw too that she got leprosy. You must forgive too. I forgave her also on your behalf, because I know that you are good, O women of Bethsaida, who greet me, shouting, blessed the Lamb of God, blessed who is coming in the name of the Lord. If I am the Lamb, and you know me as such, if I am the Lamb come amongst you, you must also become meek sheep, also those whom the pain of an unfaithful husband, a pain of a long time ago, provides with the instinct of a beast that defends its den. If you were tigers or hyenas, I, the Lamb, could not stay with you. So in other words, she caused a rage within these women who wanted to defend their family. And they had to, in other words, be forgiving now. The Pharisees accused Jesus of two things. First, for healing on the Sabbath, and for approaching a woman who had been a prostitute. He challenges them to search the Scriptures and try to find a passage that forbids a doctor from curing a sick person, or a Levite from taking care of the altar, or a priest from listening to a believer because it was the Sabbath. He then says, I am the doctor, the Levite, the priest. If I do not do my duty, and I lose only one of the souls anxious to be saved, God the Father will ask me to account for it and will punish me for losing it. So Jesus invites them to become redeemers, namely to sacrifice themselves, to suffer, to cooperate in the redemption of man. He wants them to join him in the God's plan of redemption of souls. And he says that they will not understand now, but when the Holy Spirit will come, he will enlighten them to see that they're invited to become co-redeemers, the highest dignity that a man can have. But they must prepare themselves for this dignity. They must have pure hearts and intentions. He wants them to begin with their bodies, beginning with the five senses, the seven passions, and then moves on to their souls, the intellect. He calls the eye, the physical eye, the king of the senses, because the eye opens a path to the most painful and complicated appetites. For example, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the world for wealth, gold, the lust after power. And he says, let your eyes be peaceful, honest, sober, pure, and your desires will be peaceful, honest, sober, and pure. If you possess the chastity of the flesh, you will possess the chastity of riches and power. You will be the friends of God. And he warns them not to be afraid to be mocked because of their chastity. Be afraid only of offending God. He now mentions that there is a higher state of life before which the angels bow down, namely a virginal life that consecrates body and soul to the service of God. And he prophesies that in the future centuries, quote, the altar will be served and surrounded by such persons who preserve their body and heart chaste for the God. He now intends to enter Philip's home and share his food, but before this, he encounters Matthew again, who has been listening and looks at him as if he were blessing him. Jesus does that. He's looking at him and as if we're blessing him. So now we finally have the call of Matthew. This is page 511. The scene is a warm day in the market square of Capernaum at the end of the business day. Jesus is approaching the square in the middle of his group, coming from the lake. He's chatting with the children who are playing there. A little girl approaches with a bleeding scratch on her head and is crying. She's blaming her brother. But the brother says he did not mean it because he was trying to shake some figs from a tree with a big stick, and the stick fell out of his hand and accidentally hit his sister. So it wasn't, in other words, intentional. But we pick up the scene and the conversation there between Jesus and the child. So as he's talking to the children, he says, well then, you can see that your brother did not want to hurt you. On the contrary, he wanted to make you happy. So make peace at once and give each other a kiss. Good little brothers and sisters and all good children must never bear a grudge. Come on now. So they make up. And so the dinner is now prepared. I'm a little ahead of myself. So the two children kiss each other, and Jesus says, well, now I see that you are being good. I will pick the figs for you, and with a stick. Now, a woman rushes up to Jesus and apologizes for her children's troubles. And she says, how troublesome they are. But Jesus says, children are never a nuisance. Jesus could say that, right? All right. So Jesus could say that. Children are never a nuisance. Well, I think if we have enough love of God in us, we could say that too. Right? Children are never a nuisance. Okay. All right. Let me pick this up now. And they like sweet figs, and I like their sweet, innocent souls. They take so much bitterness away from me. So he's now in the square, and he goes straight to Matthew's tax counter. Now, this is the moment of truth for Matthew. Jesus has been sending him all kinds of graces and thoughts. So now he's about to call Matthew. He stares at Matthew, who rises to his feet immediately in a reverent attitude. It is a piercing glance, but the glance of a call and of love. Matthew is enraptured and filled with love. He blushes. He doesn't know what to do or say. And so Jesus says, we pick up their conversation here on page 513, the last few lines at the bottom of the page. He says, Matthew, son of Alphaeus, your hour is striking. Come, follow me, orders Jesus majestically. I, Master, Lord, but do you know who I am? I'm saying that for your sake, not for mine. Come, follow me, Matthew, son of Alphaeus, Jesus repeats more kindly. Oh, how can I have found grace before God? I, Matthew, son of Alphaeus, I've seen into your heart. Come, follow me. This third invitation is a caress. And Matthew says, oh, at once, my Lord. And Matthew, weeping, comes out from behind the counter without bothering to pick up the coins, spread over it to close the coffer. Nothing. Where are we going, my Lord? He asks when he's near Jesus. Where are you taking me? To your house. Will you give hospitality to the Son of Man? Oh, but what will those who hate you say? I listen to what is said in heaven, and they are saying there, glory be to God for a sinner who is being saved. And the Father says, mercy will rise forever in heaven and will hover over the earth. And since I love you with an eternal perfect love, I will have mercy also on you. Come. And with my coming, as well as your heart, may also your house be sanctified. I've already purified it because of a certain hope I had in my heart, but I could not reasonably believe it might come true. Oh, I with your holy friends. And he looks at the disciples. That's Matthew talking. Yes, Jesus said, with my friends, come, I'm joining you together. Be like brothers. So the dinner is now prepared in Matthew's house, and he invites Jesus and the disciples to come, and he gives instructions to the servants. Again, we pick up the scene here on page 514. About the last half of the page. Matthew goes out to give instructions while Jesus and his disciples refresh themselves. And Matthew says, come now, Master, the dining room is cooler. My friends are coming. Oh, I want a big celebration. It's my regeneration. It's my true circumcision. You have circumcised my heart with your love. Master, it will be the last feast. No more feast now for Matthew. The excise man. No more worldly feasts. Only an internal rejoicing because I have been redeemed and I'm serving you and I'm loved by you. How much I have cried. How about that? How much during the past months I have been crying for almost 3 months. I did not know what to do. I wanted to come. But how could I, with my unclean soul, come to you, the Holy One? And Jesus says, you were cleansing it with repentance and charity towards me and your neighbor. Now he looks at Peter. Peter, come here. Remember when that little pouch was given? Yeah. Some time ago, and Peter was saying, who's giving this? And so this is where Peter finally learns the truth. And after Jesus calls Peter and places him between them, and he says, Peter, here is the unknown man of the purse. When James used to bring it to us in front of you. And here we see what Peter does. Page 515, top of the page. And Peter says, who that robber? Oh, forgive me, Matthew. He's going to say robber. Who could have imagined it was you? And that you were able to tear out a piece of your... Listen to that, Peter. that you are able to tear out a piece of your heart every week and make that rich offering, you who were our despair on account of your usury. He doesn't mince words. Matthew says, I know I taxed you unfairly, but now I kneel down before you all, and I say to you, do not reject me. He has accepted me. Don't be more severe than he is. Now Peter, who sees Matthew is at his feet, suddenly lifts him bodily, roughly, but affectionately. Stand up. You don't have to ask me and the others to forgive you. You must ask him. Never mind. We are more or less thieves like you. Oh, I have said it. Cursed be my tongue. But that's me. I say what I think, and what's in my heart is also on my lips. Come, let us make a pact of peace and love. And he kisses Matthew on his cheeks. Now Judas Iscariot blurts out, now here's the troublemaker, see? Blurts out that Jesus should be careful about consorting with an excise man. Just after he had been dealing with a prostitute, saying, do you want to ruin us all? By now, Peter has been building up a head of steam. Here's Jackie Gleason again, you know, with that fist. And he bursts out with some biting words, which we will pick up here. And he's being very nasty in words. And he says to Judas, I know you're not speaking to me. I instead am speaking to your noble soul, to your most pure and wise soul. I know that you, a member of the temple, smell the stench of sin in us poor people who are not of the temple. I am aware that you, a full Judean, a blend of Pharisee, Sadducee, and Herodian, half scribe, and a dash of an Essene, do you wish any more noble words? I am aware you do not feel at home with us, and you are like a magnificent aloes caught in a net full of gudgeons. What can we do? He caught us, and we're staying. If you feel uncomfortable, you'd better go away. We shall all have some respite. Also he who, is irritated with me and with you. With me because I lack patience, and also, yes, also charity. But even more with you, because you understand nothing, notwithstanding all your alleged attributes, and you have neither charity nor humility nor respect. You have nothing, my boy, except a lot of hot air. He's calling him a gas bag. And God grant that that hot air is harmless. Well, so meanwhile, Jesus has been listening to all this with folded arms, pressed lips, and stern and piercing look, and he addresses Peter. Have you also cleansed your heart of the yeast that was inside it? You have done the right thing. Christ's call is like the blood of the Lamb on your souls. And where his call is, there will be no more faults. No word is spoken to Judas. Peter is quiet and mortified. Matthew is coming in with his friends, and Jesus says to the disciples, do not let us show them anything but virtue. Whoever is not capable of doing so should go out. Do not be like Pharisees, who oppress people with precepts which they cannot keep themselves. And so they've had the banquet, and it's at an end when three Pharisees, Eli, Simon, and Joachim, ask to come in. Notice they're always in the background. They're always spying on Jesus. And they always come apparently at the right time when they can catch him, or so they think. Jesus goes to meet them with Matthew and tells them about the joy of Matthew's conversion. But the Pharisees are scandalized because they see other men there who they say are procurers of women, adulterers, keepers of a gambling house. And at their accusations to the disciples, Jesus says, leave my disciples in peace. I wanted it. Only I. One of the Pharisees says, obviously you wanted it. When one acts as a saint and is not a saint, one falls into unpardonable errors. Another Pharisee, Eli, says, one teaches what he knows. And then Jesus replies, and we pick that up on page 517. He says, you are wrong, Eli. You are all wrong. One teaches what one knows. It is true. And I know the law, and I teach those who do not know it. That is, sinners. I know that you are already masters of your souls. Sinners are not. I am looking for their souls, which I give back to them, so that they may bring them to me again, as they are, sick, wounded, soiled, and I may cure and cleanse them. I have come for that. It is sinners that need the Savior, and I have come to save them. Try and understand me, and do not hate me without cause. Now Jesus is gentle, convincing, and humble, but the three Pharisees are, that word is hisped, thistles, all covered with aculei, and they go out showing disgust, meaning their hearts as hard as rocks. After this, Judas Iscariot says, again, here he is now, more trouble. We will now be criticized everywhere. And Jesus says, let them do as they wish. Make sure only that the Father, meaning in heaven, does not criticize you. We're moving to a new chapter now on page 516. I probably made a mistake here. Jesus is on the Lake Tiberias, right?
Yes.
All right, I have a misprint number here. And he gives a lesson to his disciples. He's on a lake of Galilee with 13 disciples in two boats. They're moving along close to each other, and the disciples are talking between the boats. And Jesus is in the prow of the boat enjoying the beautiful scenery and the peaceful surroundings. He's lost in thought. Several leisure boats filled with beautiful women and men who are Roman, Greek, and Palestinian are making merry with foolish talk and empty laughter. Their leisure boats are cutting across the path of disciples' boats. In one of the leisure boats, one can see Mary of Magdala with her head in the lap of a Roman. As the boats almost collide, there are insults from the leisure boats. The Romans are saying, get out of the way, you dirty Jewish dogs. That's all Peter needs to hear. And Peter returns insult for insult, and he includes the Jewish women too, with words that Maria Del Torta does not wish to repeat. And Jesus seems unaware of the commotion. His mind is far away. He doesn't even look at the people in the leisure boats. But remember this, he knows Mary Magdalene is there. As God, he's zapping her. See? Even though one of the women throws a flower at him and almost hits his face. Judas sees the Magdalene and he tries to stir up a nasty conversation. There he is again, stirring up trouble. A nasty conversation about her with the disciples, especially Simon Zealot, because he's a close friend of Lazarus and Mary Magdalene is a sister to Lazarus. See? But Simon refuses to carry on the conversation. So Judas now turns to Peter, and he tries to engage him in a talk about the Magdalene. But Peter, too, dodges his questions about the scandal of the Magdalene. The conversation is moving to a more heated discussion with Peter, becoming quite annoyed with Judas. Jesus now stops the conversation, to which he pretends he was not listening, but with the words, is that Tiberias over there? And he asks Peter to go closer to the shore because he wants to talk to the disciples. They all remain in the boat, and then Jesus, while they're in the boat, begins to talk. And this is on page 521. It's more to the bottom of the page in the middle. And he says, listen, you may think that I do not pay attention to your conversation, and that consequently I am a lazy teacher who doesn't look after his pupils. You must know that my soul does not leave you one moment. Have you ever seen a doctor who studies a patient affected by a disease not yet identified and presenting contrasting symptoms? He keeps an eye on him. After visiting him, he watches him both when he sleeps and is awake, in the morning and in the evening, when he speaks and when he's silent, because every symptom may help to identify the hidden disease and suggest a cure. I do the same with you. I hold you by means of invisible but most sensitive threads, which are grafted into me, and they transmit to me even the lightest vibrations of your ego. I allow you to believe that you are free, though you may reveal that you may reveal yourselves for what you are, which happens when a schoolboy or a maniac thinks that he's not being watched by his overseer. Notice the thought here. Could this woman have put words like that in Jesus' mind? But we know, in other words, that he's God. He could do this. But there's so many insights that are very insightful that you would say she could not have put all this together. Jesus continues, you are a group of people, but you form a nucleus. That is, one thing only. You are therefore a unit, which is formed as a body, and which is to be studied in its individual features, which are more or less good, in order to shape it, amalgamate it, round it off, increase it in its polyhedric size, and make it a perfect unit. That is why I study you. And I study you also when you are sleeping. As God, he's always with us. So Jesus tells them that they are the salt of the earth, and he wants to fill them with a celestial flavor. He reminds them that they lose this flavor when they become too involved in their humanness. Jesus communicates his strength to them, but it fails if they dissipated under avalanches of human influences and feelings. He also tells them that they must be the light of the world. He is the light of God among men and shares his light with his disciples. But if they extinguish this light in themselves with the smoke of their faults and sins, they will be cursed and punished. And he says, you have been given the most both in education and gifts. You are educated by me, and you receive from God the gift of being the disciples, that is, the continuators of the Son of God. He challenges them to examine themselves, and if they do not think they can be what he wants them to be, namely apostles, then let them leave. The world offers many attractive things that satisfy the stomach and the senses. And page 523, we pick up the rest of the thought here. At top of the page, second line, I offer but one thing, holiness. And on the earth, it is the meanest, the poorest, the roughest, the thorniest, and the most persecuted thing that exists. In heaven, its meanness is changed into immensity, its poverty into riches, its thorniness into a flowery carpet, its hardness into a smooth, pleasant path, its persecution into peace and beatitude. But here it is a hero's labor to be a saint. That is all I can offer. Now, this is how Jesus offered vocations. He didn't offer swimming pools and the best in what the world can offer, beautiful grounds and all that kind of thing, you know, to draw people. Young men being drawn to vocations today are being offered something like that, and here they're leaving all that. So they're not impressed by that kind of a vocation draw. Jesus laid it on the line. You're going to have it tough, you're going to suffer, but he says, you'll have heaven, you'll have me, you'll have the fruits of the Spirit, you'll have strength, you'll have all that you need. But you will suffer, but you'll have joy, you'll have my love. So he balanced all that. So now Jesus strongly admonishes them to leave the group if they think they're not suited for the ministry of the apostle. Better to leave than to betray him, as well as God and their own souls, by falling into the traps of Satan. He said a person like that would be a cancer, infecting the body of the apostles. And he continues that thought towards the bottom of the page there. He said, listen, in a few years' time, you will be less fervent than now, that you are neophytes. Such is life, such is mankind. You lose impetus after the first step, leap. But Jesus springs to his feet now. But I swear to you that I will win, purified by natural selection, fortified by a supernatural mixture. You, better ones, will become my heroes, the heroes of Christ, the heroes of heaven. The power of the Caesars will be like dust as compared to the regality means the royal appearance of your priesthood. You poor fishermen of Galilee, you unknown Judeans, you were mere numbers in the mass of present men, will become more famous, more acclaimed, venerated than Caesar, than all the Caesars of the world ever had or will have. You will be known and blessed in the near future and in the most remote centuries until the end of the world. And those are the apostles. And they have the highest honor in the church and celebration of the saints. He now outlines the essential qualities that are to be found in the character of an apostle. He says, first, be always vigilant and ready. In other words, to seek out and convert sinners and guide them to God. Second, they must be faithful to the Master. They must not become lazy, careless in their duties, and be blind to the fact that they will have many temptations. Third, he said, be honest. Avoid acting in two different ways as politicians do. It's not a compliment to be a politician. He says, let God see you as you wish to be seen by men. Fourth, be humble. Be humble, gentle, patient, after my example. Be strong and violent against your vices. But the world is not conquered by violence and force. And fifth, be sincere. He says, I am the truth, but in sublime and human things, be genuine. Do not be deceitful with me or with your brothers or neighbors. God sees into your hearts. Sixth, be detached in doing good, also in giving alms. Do not reveal your goodness before a crowd. A good action is detached when it is free of any thoughts of pride and praise. Seven, persevere in your vocation to God. You cannot serve two masters, God and Satan. Satan offers you deceitful riches, power, honor, success, wealth, markets that demand your soul as the price. Be satisfied with little. God gives you what is necessary. He wants reliance and moderation from you. And number eight, do not be heathens by being for God only in name, that is, loving gold and power, and looking like demigods rather than loving God. Nine, do not be intolerant. Since you are all sinners, behave towards others with mercy and forgiveness. Ten, do not judge. You have seen how many times I've been wrongly judged. A bad judgment is an insult. But forgive. Always forgive. Say, I forgive, Father, that I may be forgiven by you of my numberless sins. 11. Improve hourly with patience, perseverance, heroism. It is painful to become good. It is the greatest labor, but the reward is heaven. And last of all, 12, love. There are no words that will persuade you to love poor men moved by Satan. Jesus prays to the Father to hasten the time when he can send the Holy Spirit, divine love, to fill his disciples with his love. So he didn't miss anything. See, that was a theological school of the best kind. He had them under his divine microscope all the time. In the next chapter, Jesus looks for Jonathan in the house of Chusa at Tiberias. Jonathan was one of the shepherds 30 years ago, present at Jesus' birth. And now he was contacting all of them. He will eventually. And he was now taken into the house of Chusa, who was a steward in Herod's house. He himself was quite wealthy too. And Chusa's wife was Joanna, whom he's going to heal later on in this chapter. Now Jesus seems to have disembarked in the suburbs of Tiberias and is walking with Peter along the lake. The shepherd Joseph is also with him. He's looking for Jonathan, who is the steward for Chusa, who himself is the steward in